Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Pearlman. My guest is Deborah C. Hoard. Hoard is president of Photosynthesis Productions, a film and video production company located in Ithaca, New York. She has been a producer, writer, and researcher for PSP for 25 years. Her work has focused on social justice and education issues and has won over 100 international and national awards. Her most recent film to be released in June is called Civil Warriors, a spoken word historical film about 26 black men from Ithaca who fought in the Civil War. It will air at Ithaca's independent movie house, Cinemopolis. And I welcome you to the show, Deborah.
Thank you.
Now, tell us what got you into film, video, this kind of a career.
I'm just lucky, I guess. My education has nothing to do with film or video. But I guess my mother says I always, since I was a baby, like to tell people what to do. And it turns out being a film producer and a director, that is my job. I get to do that. And I was lucky enough to get involved working with David Gluck and Peter Carroll, who founded Photosynthesis almost 30 years ago. I got hired to be a production assistant and learned the business from the bottom up. And so now I own the business, and I get to do the kind of work I really want to do, which is very exciting.
Amazing. What a great metamorphosis to go from not knowing anything to owning the company. Now tell us, I know you've worked for 25 years with Photosynthesis. What was it that got you so interested in social justice issues in particular? Were you an activist as a young woman at all?
Well, yes, in the sense that I grew up in California and went to Berkeley in the 60s. So I learned to protest as a freshman and also learned some of the shortcomings of some of the kinds of protest that we used back in the day. And as I got to work with Photosynthesis and discovered the power of film, mm-hmm. I thought this is a way I can really have an impact beyond my community. It's very exciting.
It's still such an exciting way to tell a story, to be able to tell a story on film, because people are interested. They don't feel like they're being preached to, like at a demonstration. You know what I mean?
And one of the hallmarks of Photosynthesis's work, it's very documentary style. Even if we're working for Cornell or a client, which we do a lot, we tend to shoot it at documentary style, meaning we're asking people to tell us things they believe and get the honest voices of experience and tell our story that way. So most of our work is not narrated or contrived in that way. It's really just the voices of experience.
Yeah, that's what's made documentary so incredibly important in our culture, I think. Now, you're president of Photosynthesis.
Yes.
Tell us what your duties are. I mean, day to day, what are you in charge of everything that comes through, every project?
Yes. It's a challenge, but I like it that way. I like to know what's going on, and now that it's my company, if it has Photosynthesis on it, I want to be sure it represents, it can be something I'm proud of.
Mm-hmm. So you're involved in the nuts and bolts of everything that's happening.
I do the dishes, too.
And you okay the projects? That's what I was wondering.
It's funny. People often ask me, how do you get new work? And most of our work now is self-produced, or somebody calls me and says, hey, I've heard about you. I want to do a video about X. So it's a wonderful position to be in because lots of interesting things walk through the door. I just met a guy who's a puppeteer, and all of a sudden I'm producing a puppet show for preschoolers.
So everything's on your back. You know, when I talk to authors, they talk about the importance of having an editor.
Yes.
So do you have people that you knock ideas around with who can say, hey, Deborah, this doesn't sound quite right for us?
Yes, very much so. And I also have a staff of editors so that we get an idea, we might shoot something, and then goes into the editing suite. And there's a huge amount of work that goes into post-production because, of course, a film we're in post-production now on Cambodia. We have 150 hours of footage, and we're making a feature film, which will probably be 85 minutes long.
That's so amazing how people can
every second
that.
We're using, we're throwing out many, many more, and it's very hard to make those choices.
I would think that the post-production would be the real trick of the art in many ways.
Yes. Well, of course, then the cameramen and cinematographers say it's the other side of it. But I think it all adds up.
Yeah.
But you really do have to have something good on camera. But then editing makes all the difference, it's true.
Absolutely.
It can really affect the emotion and the mood and the impact.
Yeah. Now, let's talk about some of the projects you've worked on. One was called Struggle for Identity, Issues on Transracial Adoption.
Yes.
I find that one really interesting.
That came about because one of my colleagues was in the process of adopting a child from South America, and he said, you know, there's just, we go to these trainings, and I wonder if there's something more we could do. So we collaborated with an Ithaca group called the New York State Citizens Coalition for Children and made a 20-minute training film about the challenges of transracial adoption. Because in that situation, adoption by itself is
hard enough.
But then you add the other layer of the family and the child being of different race or culture. And lots of times there are situations where you're in a community where there's not good diversity. And so you have all these issues about race and all these issues about family. And you put them all together, and it can be a big deal for families. And our purpose on these, it was freeing for us in that we aren't trying to answer all the questions. We're just trying to have people understand what they're getting into so that they know that a white family adopting a child of color, that love is not enough.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You think that's something you hear all the time. You know, love is enough, and I'll love them, and it'll be fine. But there's really a difference in parenting and culture and a lot of things that you might not know about.
Yeah.
So
who did you talk to for this film? Obviously not just the families, but people who direct the adoption agencies.
Actually,
and
the
so
people on camera are all either young adult transracial adoptees or their parents.
Oh.
Again, the voices of experience. We didn't want experts telling us stuff. We wanted to talk to people who had lived through it. And yet our interviewees had all emerged as competent, successful adults. It wasn't like their life was ruined.
Were there ever conflicts between the adoptees and the parents?
Oh, very much so.
Yeah.
Because many of them, they talked about when they go through their, I'm not your race, I'm different, and the rebellion and all of the various things. So that was part of the piece, too, is preparing families for some of the issues that are almost bound to come up.
Wow.
And just to be honest about it.
Yeah.
And to face it together. And love is important.
Yeah.
But education and understanding is too.
How did you prompt the people to talk about these issues? Did you have a set of questions
and
just record the on-camera answers?
We recorded just several days of group discussion. And again, it was when we had 8 hours of talking, and the film is 20 minutes long.
Wow.
And then one thing that I like about it is that Struggle for Identity was very successful and has sells all over the world. And that was many years ago. So 10 years later, we re-interviewed two of the people and put it out on a DVD with both 20-minute films. So it's the original and then a follow-up conversation 10 years later. And it's very interesting to me to find out that 10 years later, the issues were all the same.
Wow.
I mean, these people were now in their 40s, but they still had the same issues and concerns and thoughts of their birth parents or not thoughts of their birth parents. One person was trying to find them, one wasn't. Anyway, both of those films together are still very much in use in trainings all over the country and the world.
Yeah, those issues are incredibly important. Now, in documentary film, is there generally an angle that you're looking for as a producer, or do you collect material and just see how it unfolds? How do you do that?
Well, people may say they just collect. I think you have a point of view. I mean, just by the fact that the camera sees a very small piece of reality.
Yeah,
wherever you point your camera, you're seeing that little piece. And whatever you choose to use in the edit is what you choose to use. So very definitely, I think people have a point of view. And that's usually why it's an advocacy piece or something like that that often drives a lot of documentary filmmakers, I think. They want to change the world.
And a lot of people won't admit that it has an angle to it, you know? I mean, to me, it seems like it would.
Yes. It's not journalism. It's not and one could point out that journalism has a point of view in
absolutely
many places, too. But
we're
not just the facts, although we are honest and straightforward about it, but we have a point of view.
Yeah. I worked at KPFA in Berkeley,
and
I know we had a point of view at that station. And, you know, and a lot of people think, oh, my gosh, you're a journalist. You shouldn't. But it seems to me it's impossible as a human being not to have some point of view. You also did a film called Gay Parents Speak.
Yes.
Tell us about that one. That's very relevant still.
That was a follow-up, really, to Struggle for Identity, because we found that there was a great need for this sort of short training video or where it could be used in workshops and discussion groups. So the video could be shown, and then the group would have another 40 minutes or an hour to discuss. And we found that we felt there was a need to do that same sort of training and recruitment thing for same-sex couples. Mm-hmm. And that was a fascinating experience, too. We filmed that in collaboration with the Human Rights Campaign in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. and they brought in a lot of people from their own circles. And it's interesting that a lot of those issues of adoption and the issues of race are huge in those relationships, too, because often the children that are available are of a different race than the adoptive parents in those systems, although not exclusively.
Is it hard to get people to speak for documentaries like this? You know, I mean, obviously it isn't as much a case now, but the closet in regard to gay couples used to be a major issue.
It's not nearly as much as it used to be, I think. It used to be when we were shooting film and schools back in the day, and you turn the camera on and everybody would start waving and saying, "Hi, Mom," and what channel are we going to be on? And now a lot of the young people we're interviewing about things were probably videotaped at birth.
Yeah, exactly.
And although at the same time there is the suspicion that their words or voices and likeness can be misused and misrepresented.
Oh, absolutely.
That happens all the time. And so that's a big issue for us in terms of having respect and trust with your subjects.
Yeah, exactly.
And they have to know that we're not going to cut it so that it says things they didn't say.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's really important to me.
You know, when I first started doing this show, I always let people speak for themselves. I don't edit. And I've had so many guests say, I'm shocked that you didn't edit this and cut it to suit your point of view is. You know, I mean, I'm obviously just trying to showcase people's creativity mm-hmm. and biography and stuff. But that is so prevalent, that shaping of people's, you know, voices.
But and respecting the fact that people are sharing their lives with us all the time, and not to misuse that trust.
Yeah. Yeah, because that could cascade into a bad reputation, mm-hmm. which would really hamper your company. Now, as someone who does interviews, I know that I have to make people comfortable and not seem robotic, try to make sure that they're, you know, acting like human beings in front of microphones. Is there any technique that you use? Because I know cameras can make people incredibly self-conscious.
Yes, I try to reassure people that we are really just having a conversation like you and I are here, and that our goal is to have everybody speak their truth and to look good. You know, we're not 60 minutes, we used to say.
Uh-huh.
One of the things I do is I really look people straight in the eye the whole time they're talking, and I never look at my notes while they're speaking to me.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And I've been told I am expressive. I've developed a way of nodding and smiling without speaking, because you can't go, mm-hmm, or even say, oh, yes, or why. You have to be quiet while the person is talking. So I like to think that I can nod and smile and look questioning and respond to them and look them right in the eye the whole time.
Uh-huh. And do you do kind of a pre-getting-to-know-somebody thing?
It depends. A lot of the people I interview are busy. You know, they want to sit down and get started. So we have to develop our relationship right on camera. And usually, you know, we're a low-key crew. It's a small group. Usually it's not too much of a problem. People get nervous anyway. I would be.
See, I want to ask you this, too, because you didn't come from this filmmaking video arena. How did you develop your skills? I mean, how did you develop skills as an interviewer?
Watching other people do it for 20 years before I was sitting in the director's chair and really paying attention.
So, yeah, that's, I mean,
and learning what not to do as well as what to do.
Having
and
role
then,
models is
also
a great.
Also developing my own confidence to know what I wanted to know and to ask people. I one of the things I like to do is to ask an unexpected question, like, well, why do you do this? Why are you a teacher? And then people go, oh. And then sometimes they just tell me.
They go off, yeah. If you're just joining us, my guest is filmmaker Deborah Hoard. She's president of Photosynthesis Productions, a film and video production company located in Ithaca. So let's talk about this fascinating new project that you're just finishing up called Civil Warriors.
Yes.
It sounds absolutely fascinating. I love history. To tell us about it.
This is a project that means a great deal to me, because it was one of the first things that I started and am producing really on my own with valuable collaborators and partners, but it was my idea to do it. And I've raised the money, and I'm making it happen. So it's the story. It's based on and it was inspired by a play written by Carol Kamen,
a local historian.
Who did a great deal of research and wrote a play called I Am a Man Too, and that title takes off from a speech that Sojourner Truth gave way back in 1854, I think, where she proclaimed, "Ain't I a woman?"
And very famous.
So at any rate, that was Carol's play. And I heard it produced, actually my collaborator, Che Broadnax, who is my co-producer and director on this, and I saw her play produced as a dramatic reading. And we were sitting there and thinking, and we had actually just finished Struggle for Identity, which is just Talking Heads.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought, well, we could do this. We could make this into a movie, you know, take the dramatic reading format and see what we can do with it. So I bought the rights to the play from Carol, and which was just kind of a big deal and for me at the time. And then we worked with the material, and we hired a local spoken word poet, Ben Porter Lewis, who's to rewrite the play in spoken word. So it's sort of a mashup of history and modern spoken word. There are six performers on a bare stage that we filmed individually, and it's woven together with music and now commentary by another local historian, Sean Eversley Bradwell.
Oh, yes, yes.
So, who provides the sort of contemporary point of view.
Well, tell us what it's about, though. It's fascinating.
Oh, okay.
It's 26
black men from Ithaca,
yeah,
who enlisted in the U.S. Colored Troops at the AME Zion Church downtown on Cleveland Ave, which is, I believe, the oldest building in the county. And a recruiter came on Christmas Eve of 1863, and many of these men and many of the first people to enlist were the teenagers, the 17, 18-year-old boys who felt, oh, this was a chance not only to stand up and be a man and a soldier, but to travel and to fight for their brothers in the South.
Wow.
So what's interesting in this situation, which is apparently not all that uncommon, is that two of the young men, John Sorrell and John Tyler, their fathers also enlisted to go with their progeny, and one of them was Reverend Zachariah Tyler, who went with his flock, essentially. He was 44, and he enlisted and fought in the South with his son and others from Tompkins County.
God, that's amazing. So, you know, a lot of people don't even know black people were in the services in the military during the Civil War.
Yes, and it wasn't until the end of the war, where there's a number of different theories on how it came to this point, but they needed more men to fight, and black men were eager to go. It was, for some of them, it was not something they would have chosen to go fight a war, but must have been an evocative challenge to have an impact on their world, and they did.
And so, what is the point of view of the speakers in this film? Are they talking about their experience or why they did this?
Yes, and why they would want to go and fight. And we have in one of there's a woman, the wife and mother of her name is Sydney Sorrell, and both her son and her husband went off to fight. And one of the scenes that's very moving in our film is when she is told there's news for her from the War Department. So that means someone is dead.
Yeah.
And she doesn't know whether it's her son or her husband. And so that's a very difficult, she has to go walk to get the news, and she's struggling with a choice in her mind. I mean, will she be relieved if it's one or the other? And she's already feeling guilty about how she's going to feel when she finds out who is gone.
Wow, knowing you're walking to find out
for
sure.
And it was her husband, Edward Sorrell, who was shot on picket duty in South Carolina, and is, you know, his body is buried in some mass grave there. Interestingly, all of the characters in our film are all, except for, he's not buried, but there's a marker, but all the rest of them are buried here in Tompkins County.
And as a filmmaker, how was this filmed? you know, it's just people talking. It would be static as a film if it wasn't.
Well, we went all out, and I have to say that the Park Foundation generously provided funding to really to shoot it right. We rented the stage, Schwartz Center at Cornell. Ah. We got a jib. We got a high-end camera. We used extremely talented cast who they were speaking individually on stage, one at a time, looking straight at the camera, delivering these lines. It's poetry.
Yeah,
imagine. It has a real rhythm that adds something to the story that's different. And part of the reason we did that is that our goal is not just to have this scene in theaters or on PBS, but to have it be the centerpiece of an educational DVD that's for 11th grade classrooms nationwide.
Uh-huh.
Because I think that's where you can make a difference. As if 17-year-olds in Kansas and Omaha, everywhere, see this as something, and outside of February.
Yeah,
so
Black
it's not
History
just Black
Month.
History
yeah,
Month.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, I started thinking I don't want to show it in February. That's the only month I don't want to.
Yeah.
That because it's American history.
Absolutely.
And to get people from all over to recognize that, I think could be very constructive, especially with all of the things that are going on now in our country.
I think
that this is a good time to look back at how we got here. And then it can help us figure out, how to move forward.
Yeah, yeah. This is a very important time in our history to have films like this come out. You mentioned in your personal material that one of the highlights of your career was meeting the Dalai Lama. So talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, we were also lucky. Our office is right across Cascadilla Creek from the Dalai Lama's personal monastery, mm-hmm. which is his only personal monastery outside of India.
Wow, I didn't know that.
In the world. And people often say, well, why? How did that happen? And I say, well, watch my film. But I will tell you that an Ithacan was traveling in Tibet and was fascinated by the Dalai Lama and thought, well, gee, I'm going to try to meet him. So he went and did and invited him to Ithaca, and the Dalai Lama came. So his personal monastery is here, and we were hired by them to follow him around for 4 days. When he was here in 2007, I believe.
Well, I remember
when
he was here.
He did a number of appearances. And so we were just with him and for 4 days.
And were there any restrictions put on,
presence? We did not interview him directly.
Mm.
And he doesn't like bright lights in his face. You notice he often wears a visor.
Yeah,
and things.
He does. Yeah.
So you have to, when he was on camera, we had to be careful that it was lit so that it didn't bother his eyes. But we just saw him interacting with the local Tibetan community and with the Cornell community and Ithaca College, and seeing his true, he really is just like you'd imagine. He's very there. When he's looking at you, he's really looking at you.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And was there a reason why you couldn't interview him? Is that part of the
protection? Yes, that was not part of our deal. That. But we have made a short documentary about his visit here. And I would like to find the funding to turn it into more than that, because we have lots more material and we could follow up some more. But that's on my short list.
So did meeting him change you as a filmmaker or as a person? Did it affect you in other ways?
It did affect me. I don't know that it changed me, but I just felt the peacefulness that he feels.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was very inspiring to think that, he's just a human being. He's flesh and blood, too.
Yeah, yeah.
And so
I wish you could have asked him how he does that peaceful thing, because this is a culture of such frantic craziness right now.
Yes.
And chaos. And
so it was really inspiring to see that. And it reminded me, the only other person I met that really exuded that same was Fred Rogers. Because I met him once.
Really? Mr. Rogers?
Mr. Rogers was here in Ithaca once. This was before I was making movies. But I was on Mr. Rogers as a member of building a playground that he came to videotape. And he had that same aura about him. It was really interesting to me.
Wow. I wonder what that is. Assuming they can't bottle it and sell it. Now, I want to ask you this as a follow-up to what we were just talking about. Have any of the films or videos that you've worked on and done research on changed you in any way or surprised you so much that it kind of jolted you?
almost, I mean, so many of the things, almost all of the projects that I have worked on for myself have been a surprise.
Hmm.
Because...
In what way?
I was... because people would say unexpected things in the process, and then they have unexpected impact or follow-up. I get... It's very satisfying to have people write from all over the world and say, I showed Struggle for Identity in my English class today, and we had the most substantive conversation on race we've ever had.
Wow. Yeah.
And stuff like that that makes it, and that surprises me, because when you're starting out, you never know whether it's going to be good or not.
Yeah, yeah.
You hope.
Yeah, are you really tuned into how people receive your work? Do you get reviews? Do you read reviews?
Do you get
commentary about the films?
It's only recently. Well, actually, I just, a couple years ago, together with Bob Lieberman, who's a Cornell physics teacher, he and I produced, they call it Myanmar, which is a film about Burma. And that was sort of a chance we took to do. It took years and it was hard to produce. But Roger Ebert rated it one of the top 12 documentaries of 2012.
Wow.
And it was reviewed and glowing reviews on the front page of the art section of the New York Times. And it's on Netflix, and they send me checks.
Wow.
Which is, like, unheard of. So that's I glued into reviews when we got that big sort of global release on that. But also recently, I've been in a situation to actually be in a theater with people watching my work.
Oh, that one must be interesting.
And I've discovered that's a whole new world, and I like it.
Because you can, they don't know you're there.
Feel when they laugh.
They're uncensored,
feel when they,
right?
You can feel them getting edgy or bored. Feel when they are gluing in, and then talk with them at the end. So I really like that part.
Oh, I would too. I'd love to sneak in.
That's June 4th, by the way.
Yes, we will mention that. We're running out of time.
Okay.
Are you working on anything besides Warriors that might be coming out?
Well, Bob Lieberman and I are producing a new film about Cambodia. It's called Cambodia: Rebirth of a Nation.
Okay.
And it's very interesting to be right there next to Burma, but a very, very different culture situation after the genocide of the Khmer Rouge in the 70s. And that's another story that is kind of hasn't been told.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I like to think that's one thing I have sort of found that I like to do is tell stories that haven't been told.
Yeah. Can you give some contact information in case people want to get in touch with you?
Right. So, Photosynthesis Productions. We're in downtown Ithaca. Our website is photosynthesisproductions.com. We've also just bought PSPNY.com, which is a little easier to spell.
Okay.
There's lots of stuff on our website, and I welcome any inquiries.
That's great. And the film is going to air at...
Civil Warriors will be at Cinemopolis on June 4th at 7 p.m.
Great. Well, I hope people will go out and see it. Deborah Hoard, thank you so much for joining us. Again, my guest has been Deborah Hoard, president of Photosynthesis Productions, film and video production company in Ithaca. Thank you, Deborah.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outoboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.